It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferrat. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we learn about an ongoing land dispute between the city of Green Bay and the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin.
First, the UW System Board of Regents is meeting today and tomorrow. One thing they won't be hearing about, the impacts of the $250 million state budget cuts to the university. UW chancellors had planned to talk about those cuts, but System President Ray Cross canceled the presentations.
Nico Savage is the higher education reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. He's been following this story. He joins us now from the Regents meeting in Green Bay. Nico, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you've been tracking this story. What was supposed to happen? What were they planning to do at this Regents meeting, the UW chancellors?
Right. So last week, University of Wisconsin System President Ray Cross asked chancellors at the different UW campuses to prepare a one-page summary, a five-minute presentation, on the ways that the $250 million two-year cut to higher education funding in the most recent state budget has been playing out on their campuses. They did that, but then on Friday, Cross said he decided that was not the right way to do it, that was not the right way to communicate the impact of those cuts, and he canceled the plan for that presentation in front of the Board of Regents.
So this was 5 minutes per campus, is that right?
Right, exactly, to run through things like layoffs, program cuts, service reductions, that sort of thing that we've been seeing as the campuses try to absorb the big cuts to higher education funding.
So what was the reasoning behind deciding not to do that, not have that couple of hours of budget cut impact?
Right. So Ray Cross acknowledges that there were several reasons why he did it, but Cross says that one of them was he was concerned about the impact that could have on future budgets for the UW system. We are going to be getting to the point fairly soon where legislators are going to be considering the next round of budgeting for state agencies, including UW. And Cross acknowledged that, you know, that's always on his mind. There is some concern that UW could be accused of exaggerating the effect of these budget cuts, or that campuses could be, you know, criticized for doing that. Now, Cross also says that the main reason why he didn't want to have that presentation happen was that, when you think about it, there's more than a dozen chancellors. You give them 5 minutes each. A lot of those presentations were going over time. It would be, Cross said, sort of a drumbeat of this news that wouldn't have the same impact as talking about the impact of those cuts more locally. So what UW officials have done is encourage campus leaders to sort of talk with their local chambers of commerce, talk with local elected officials, members of the public, communicate more locally as opposed to coming to the Regents meeting and talking about it here.
Yeah, WPR News talked to UW System spokesperson Alex Hummel, who said they want a more local approach for chancellors to take. Here's a listen.
We really need to make a broader statewide effort with the partners and other stakeholders that they work with to educate them about what's been done and also what work is coming.
So from a media standpoint, that might have more local reach in some ways, but it wouldn't have that big impact of having one chancellor after another in front of the Regents. Is that kind of the idea, keeping it a little quieter, I guess, Nico?
Well, that was a criticism that actually Democrats on the legislature's Joint Finance Committee brought up. They essentially accused UW officials and the Board of Regents of trying to sort of sweep these problems under the rug, of not allowing a broader discussion of the impact that the budget positions made by legislative Republicans and Governor Scott Walker have had. Now, UW denies that. They say that they do want to communicate about how this is happening, but that they didn't think that a bunch of presentations at one meeting was the way to do it.
Talking to Nico Savage from the Wisconsin State Journal, Regents are meeting, UW System Regents meeting today and tomorrow, and UW chancellors are not going to have a big epic presentation on the impact of budget cuts. Nico's been reporting on that over the course of this week. So the UW system is in, it sounds like you're painting a delicate situation here. They don't want to not say these budget cuts are hurting them, because then it'll look like they didn't hurt them. On the other hand, they don't want to sound, I guess, like whiners if they lay all this on the table.
That was actually exactly one of the concerns that Ray Cross had. He brought the chancellors did a sort of dry run through these presentations, and one of the things that Ray Cross brought to that was literally a big red button that when he hit it said stop whining, because he wanted these presentations to be factual, to emphasize the impact on local communities, on students, on jobs, and not just to simply be a matter of the sort of thing that people would consider folks in higher education sort of whining about a tough budget.
But when it all comes down to it, it sounds like the chancellors are going to say there are real impacts from these budget cuts.
Well, certainly. I mean, you've seen the closing of hundreds of vacant positions, which chancellors will say takes away job opportunities. You've also seen dozens of layoffs at UW-Madison and around the UW system. There have been reductions to things like advising services that help out students, reductions to community programs that these universities run. Getting out of UW-Madison, you've also seen consolidation in the two-year UW college system that's seen them lay off quite a lot of administrative staff. I mean, they'll say that there's certainly pain going around as a result of those budget cuts.
Nico, this budget has been a big story surrounding the UW system and the meetings of the regents. It's not the only big story. Also, the changes to tenure policy, especially UW-Madison, have been a big issue. And there's been a development on that today, I understand?
That's correct. So last month, the UW system passed basically a statewide tenure policy and also opened the door to campus-specific policy. So today, UW-Madison became the first campus-specific policy to go up for approval from the regents. It was approved by the regents' education committee. However, there were some small changes to it that UW officials say were not very substantive, but that professors calling for strong tenure protections say were. One of them was, for instance, clarifying that the ultimate decision maker when it comes to faculty layoffs is a chancellor, and it's not faculty governance groups. But then also some other changes to things like the requirements that chancellors pursue other options other than firing faculty, rather than just consider them, that sort of thing. But that passed the Education Committee. That will be going before the full Board of Regents when they meet tomorrow morning.
Now, some faculty have had very big concerns with these tenure changes. One of the leading critics, Sarah Goljic-Rabb, leaving the university, she says, because of those tenure changes. Do these tweaks to the UW-Madison version of those tenure changes, are they going to be something that's going to address those critiques and the strongest critics?
Well, certainly the changes that were made today are not going to do anything to please folks who have called for much stronger tenure protections. In fact, another critic of the efforts, a professor named David Van Ass, told me that he considers those very substantial changes that take, from his perspective, in the wrong direction. What university officials are hoping they can do, though, is reassure faculty both at UW-Madison and those in kind of higher education nationally, where there's been a lot of conversation about what's happening with tenure at UW. They're hoping to reassure them that, in the words of one professor I talked to today, yes, there's tenure. Yes, UW has protections and that the university is still a vibrant place.
So the tenure changes passed a committee today, going before the full Board of Regents tomorrow. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yep. And if it does, they'll be in place.
So not this big budget presentation. We do have this vote on tenure. Any other big stories you're watching at the Regents meeting?
Well, one other thing that'll be interesting to see tomorrow is that students from across UW campuses who have been pushing for improvements to campus racial climate are going to be giving a presentation to the Board of Regents. These are some of the same students who have been disrupting Regents meetings with their protest demands. It's sort of a local iteration of something that we've seen across the country with college students at campuses all over America, kind of pushing for improvements that improve the experiences of students of color.
Nico, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure, thank you for having me.
That was Nico Savage, higher education reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest has advice on the modern career and being ready to move from one job to another in an ever-changing workplace.
First, there's been a long-running dispute over land between the city of Green Bay and the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin, which just took a new turn this week.
The Oneida tribe has been working to reclaim 75% of its original reservation, and a portion of that land currently belongs to the city of Green Bay.
This has led to questions over payment for municipal services like trash collection, as well as how to enforce certain ordinances in in the overlapping areas. So far, neither side has been willing to back down from their demands.
The two sides had been working for over a year to overcome those disagreements, but in a vote last night, the Green Bay City Council decided to terminate its current service agreement with the Oneida Nation.
Joining us now to bring us up to speed on this topic is Adam Rodewald, a reporter and government watchdog for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Green Bay. Adam, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So it sounds like just last night there was some new action on this with the city of Green Bay deciding to terminate its agreement with the Oneida Nation. What does that decision mean?
Yeah, so they voted 9-3 to terminate the agreement. What that means essentially is that the tribe will no longer have to pay fees to the city of Green Bay for services provided on tribal land. And as far as I understand things right now, the city is still under some obligation to continue providing those services to tribal land. For example, they can't just stop, you know, giving fire protection to homes and businesses in the area. However, what it does is open the door for the city to now challenge the tribe's reacquisition of land and potentially put an end to their plans to reclaim their original reservation.
Right. At first glance, this seems counterintuitive. Why would the city of Green Bay decide not to collect fees for services that it provides? But it all comes down to land. Tell us how that provision is what caused this decision last night.
It probably helps to provide a little bit of context to understand the issue and dynamics here. The city of Green Bay overlaps with the historical boundaries of the Oneida Reservation. So there's roughly 4% of the city of Green Bay, which is primarily the entire west side, west of Interstate 41, lies within those original reservation boundaries. So the tribe has a goal of reclaiming that land by buying it back and placing it into these federally protected trusts, which are also tax exempt. However, the city's primarily concerned with the loss of tax base when that happens, when it does become tax exempt. So there's a huge financial implication there with regards to the ability to collect taxes, and beyond that, they lose jurisdictional control to enforce ordinances or plan development in those areas that are now the tribes.
Can you tell us a little bit more about how much of the city of Green Bay would lie within this area of land reclamation for the tribe and how the tribe has been going about trying to reclaim this land?
As I said, it's about 14% of the city. I don't know off the top of my head what that translates into acreage or square miles or anything like that. But if you're familiar with the city of Green Bay, it's essentially the entire western portion of the city west of Interstate 41. It's a pretty highly developed area along the Highway 54 or the corridor right through there. And as far as the tribe's interest in this, I guess there's a couple of reasons here for them to do this, but the bottom line is that Native American tribes have a long history of having their land taken away from them by others, and they would like it back in order to grow as well as practice their right to sovereignty. And I guess with that growth, they also have are seeing this trend of tribal members returning to the reservation as they expand and can offer more services and benefits. So they need space, too, to be able to have that for their tribal members. And then what's been going on is since sometime in the 80s when tribes were able to start opening up casinos and bringing in large amounts of revenue, it really changed the game for them, and they were able to accelerate the rate at which they're buying back that land that they had lost. The Oneida tribe specifically in 2010 passed a resolution committing tens of millions of dollars to reclaim 75% of the reservation by the year 2033. Now, ultimately, they would like to get all of it back, but as far as the portion that they've committed funding to, they say it's 75%, and the whole reservation is a little more than 65,000 acres in Brown and Outagamie counties. So where the 75% they're looking to reclaim is located, I don't exactly know. However, there are a significant number of parcels that they have within Green Bay, everything from government buildings to portions of residential neighborhoods where tribal members are living.
Tell us a little bit more about the buying back process. How does that work? Is it as simple as the tribal members purchasing pieces of public land as they come up for sale?
More or less. They would buy the land the same way anyone else would buy land, and or any other government entity would buy land. But then there's an extra step, because just because they own it doesn't necessarily mean that it's protected sovereign tribal land. They have to go through a process of submitting an application to the federal government through the Bureau of Indian Affairs to get it placed into a federally protected trust. And it's a long process. It's got a lot of steps that I don't know all the ins and outs of, but they go through that process, and then generally the city or municipality that land is also located in or co-located in would have a right to challenge that application, and then the Bureau of Indian Affairs would make a determination of what to do with it. So that kind of brings things back to what's going on with Green Bay, is they, like other municipalities in the area, had signed service agreements for providing services on that land, but there were provisions in there that that more or less prohibited the city from making those challenges. So they had no control or no say in the tribe's reacquisitions and applications, no matter what the implications might be to the municipality. So once the tribe started to be in a position to accelerate those acquisitions, some aldermen started to get concerned about what are the long-term implications for the city if this were to continue and play out all the way.
We're talking with Adam Rodewald from USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Green Bay, talking about the ongoing land dispute between the city of Green Bay and the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin. And Adam, it sounds like the nearby community, Hobart, has also been dealing with the same issue, and they've chosen to fight the tribe on this. How has what they've chosen to do played out?
So they were in a similar position several years ago, where they had a service agreement, and they started to have similar concerns as the Green Bay aldermen, and they chose pretty quickly to go ahead and cancel that service agreement and actively oppose the tribe from moving land into trusts. And so they claim that through that process, they've been able to successfully stop the tribe from acquiring 3,000 acres of land. And they estimate that that has prevented the loss of $1.5 million in property tax revenue over a six-year period to not only the village, but the county and school districts that are all within that 3,000-acre area.
And Adam, just briefly, as we wrap up, is that the same tack that you expect to see taken now with Green Bay, the city of Green Bay, and the United Nation?
Yes, very likely I would expect them to take that approach. However, there is a majority on the city council that seems eager or interested to try and work out a new agreement that might still give them some leeway in voicing concerns over the land acquisitions. So there's the potential for it to be a little bit more friendly than what's going on in Hobart, but that's so new, I don't know where things will go with that at this point in time.
Adam, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much.
That was reporter Adam Rodewald breaking down the ongoing land dispute between the city of Green Bay and the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin.
Coming up, the workplace has changed a lot in the last few decades. It's still changing quickly. Our guest has advice on getting the right job in the era of the episodic career. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up for decades, public radio listeners have heard political junkie Ken Rudin's take on politics and elections. He joins us to talk about this year's wild election cycle.
First, once upon a time in the job world, we got a job, started at the bottom, worked there for a long time, advanced maybe in pay and responsibility, and retired from that company 30-some years later. That was the ideal anyway, even if it didn't always pan out exactly that way.
But things have changed a lot, and they keep changing. New companies and technologies disrupt old workplaces, and it's becoming more and more common to have a series of jobs, maybe in very different lines of work, instead of one stable career.
In her new book, our next guest tries to help us understand the new look of our careers, figure out where we fit in, and how to navigate the ever-changing landscape. Farai Chidea joins us now. She's a journalist and political analyst. Her new book is The Episodic Career, How to Thrive at Work in the Age of Disruption. Farai, thanks a lot for joining us again.
I'm really thrilled. Thank you.
Well, we hear that the job world is different than it was, say, 30 or 40 years ago. You're saying in your book it's really different than 10 or 5 years ago, and it's going to keep changing. Can you paint the new reality of the way our careers work now?
Absolutely. Well, first thing you have to know is that the average length of time at a job is 4.4 years and dropping. So that gold watch, first of all, less of us are wearing watches, what with our phones and all, but it's probably good because the gold watch is not a reality for most people. And while there are some people who love switching jobs often, it's a lot of it is volatility, and there's two causes. One is the globalization of the economy, and the other one is basically disruptive innovation. A lot of it is automation coming from the technology side or things like Uber undermining the fortunes of cab drivers and also then providing jobs for other people. So it's not a question of whether all of the changes are bad. They're not, but they're disruptive, not just to corporations, but to individuals. So it's kind of a time to really assess how you can be flexible and adaptable.
Is it possible to have a long-term career plan, or are we just making one short-term decision after another now?
I think it's possible to make a long-term career plan, even in volatile industries, but I'll give two different models. One is that, there are industries where you may have a traditional linear career. So maybe you're someone who works in a specific type of science and you know that if you have a certain type of qualification, it looks like a long runway. I still think people can't get too comfortable. But basically what I argue for in the book is that everyone has to be in a state of psychological self-employment. And what I mean by that is that you always have to think about, do I have the skills I need to survive in the workforce? What's going on locally with my local economy? Are things going up or down or sideways? How can I be out in front of change, meaning if your company has not taken a certain step, but you see it happening in the industry, you might want to get qualified in a new program, or you might want to brush up on things that are coming down the pike, because then you're the most valuable person in the office, and you can be the one who explains things to everyone else.
A lot of what you talk about in the book is figuring out what the right job is for us now. And it's not just necessarily the dream job or the big money. And you share a lot of stories in the book. And in this case, your own personal story, you had a dream job with this this radio outfit called, I think it was NPR. I think I'm
That's
familiar
right.
with that. And it was a great job. And it was, at the same time, horrible for you. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I am someone who more than ever is concerned with work-life synergy. I don't think that there's such a thing as balance, but as I've gotten older and I'm also in the process of adopting a child, I have to think first and foremost about what it is to lead a good life. And so I loved my job at NPR, but it was sometimes on a really funky schedule, you know, having to get up at 4 a.m. or earlier to be in the office. And my body was not good with that. You know, it was one of these things where I really had an appreciable decline in my fitness and health, and I put on a lot of weight. And that may all sound trivial, but the reality is most jobs have the potential to take time off of your life. There have been a number of studies that look at both white-collar work and blue-collar work by race and gender and how they affect us. And every type of work has, you know, many potential benefits, but also potential downfalls. You know, shift work has certain, you know, perils. Overwork, you know, working more than 60 hours a week has other perils. There are many different ways in which, first of all, you know, even white-collar work can burn us out, but also everyone's different. You know, the issues I had with sleep may not be the same for someone else. You know, so you have to really be aware, not just of whether you're on a promising career track, son or daughter, but also, is this really right for your body? Is this right for your mind? Is it right for your financial health? These are all different questions that we have to ask ourselves.
Talking to Farai Chidea about her new book, The Episodic Career, How to Thrive at Work in the Age of Disruption. A big portion of your book, Farai, is devoted to assessing ourselves and how we approach our job world and the job we want now, or whether we're leaving a job looking for a new one. You break down a number of personality types. So what's the starting point? How do we figure out who we are as workers and what's going to make us, if not happy, at least fit with our lives as a worker?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that, first of all, I mean, I've been so gratified by people who've read this book and are like, okay, this lit a fire under my butt, or, you know, this is my new Bible. I never thought I'd write a career book. It's just not really what I do, but I saw so many upheavals that I felt I had to do it, and I also felt I had to be practical. So I developed a self-diagnostic tool called the Work-Life Matrix that asks 4 simple questions, including whether you're a risk-taker at work and whether you like making decisions in a team or alone. And I ran a bunch of surveys and then did follow-up interviews. And I'm really gratified that the Harvard Business Review is actually going to do an online version of this test, which is, you know, is something that makes me extremely happy, but hopefully will also help other people. Because what I saw as I spent years reporting this book were certain archetypes of individuals who had certain behavior patterns, and I wanted to find a way to drill down on that. And among the research that I got out of doing this, I found things like risk takers, not surprisingly, were more likely to be entrepreneurs, but also that people who did high social impact work, which is sometimes described as purpose-driven work or, you know, socially positive work, were less happy than people who worked for money. And so once I got a bunch of data on that, I started saying, well, why is that the case? And one of the things I found, which resonated with my own life, by the way, is that it makes sense if you think about it this way. If you set a goal of making $100,000 a year, you know when you've reached your goal. But if you set a goal of making sure all kids have an excellent education or cleaning up water pollution or stopping climate change, you know, you're probably never going to reach the finish line. So one of the things I do in this book is provide people with ways to think about not only the workplace, but their own thought patterns. So if you are someone who is doing the hard social impact work and you find yourself constantly frustrated, realize that that's probably a part of social impact work. And it doesn't mean stop doing it. It just means maybe be a little kinder to yourself.
Well, it sounds like you're saying we need to, in this job world, recalibrate maybe how we measure success, especially when we're doing those things that the success is more of an intangible than X amount of dollars or the corner office.
Yeah, and really what the four questions lead to 16 archetypes. I provide one real-life story from someone I interviewed for each of the archetypes, and then a list of careers that are likely to track with that archetype and other information like that. But I think that every archetype, and certainly every individual, has different things that they bring to the table. So, for example, if you're someone who's cautious about switching jobs or careers, you could find yourself like the frog in the slowly boiling water. Like, you're like, well, I think things are getting a little sketchy around here, but I want to stay. And you just stay at a place so long that eventually there's massive layoffs or the entire enterprise fails. And there are different perils for risk takers. And so it's really just about understanding how your inherent sensibilities fit into the workplace, as well as, of course, you know, also being kinder to yourself and recalibrating how you think about work.
And for all these different archetypes, you point toward one really portable quality that for people who lose a job or move from one job to another, it's always going to help them, and that's resilience.
Is resilience
something, though, that some of us have and some of us don't, or is it something that we can cultivate in ourselves?
You can absolutely cultivate resilience. And so resilience, in essence, is just the pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and start all over again spirit. And that's a very kind of, a sparkly little summary that we're all familiar with. But true resilience is that kind of deep inner grit where people have started companies and they failed, but they can start a new one. Or a couple of the people in the book are people with criminal histories who had to reenter the world of legal employment after having been incarcerated, which is another big challenge. So whether you're, you know, a CEO or someone who's coming out of jail, if to succeed, you're going to have that spirit of resilience, which allows you to adapt after failure and make a new plan without too much sitting around licking your wounds. And in an economy where the average job is lasting 4.4 years, that is critical, and it can be cultivated, because one of the things you can do is basically, the psychological self-employment, that attitude that I talked about, allows you to say, okay, well, I understand it's not personal that, you know, my job at place X ended, or I understand even if it was personal, I can't control how other people behave. And so you spend less time questioning your own judgment and more time being proactive.
We're talking to Fry today about her new book, The Episodic Career, How to Thrive at Work in the Age of Disruption.
And you can join in with your questions and your experiences at 800-642-1234. Has your work life been a series of different jobs? How did you make that transition from one career path to another? And if you're looking for work or maybe thinking about leaving your job, taking a risk or starting a business, how are you making that decision? You can call us at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Continuing our conversation now with Farai Chidea. Her new book is called The Episodic Career, How to Thrive at Work in the Age of Disruption.
You could join in at 800-642-1234. What's your career path looking like? Does it feel more like a maze than a path? Have you found a job that really does work for you? And what's important to you in a job? Is it all about the money? Is it flexibility, personal satisfaction, stress levels? Are you changing jobs? Are you about to change jobs? Do you want to? Or are you nervous about leaving a stable situation that's okay? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Farai, something that was interesting about your book, a lot of times job advice books are really individual focused, and you've got a lot of that there too, but you say it's important to consider the collective good too, and try to create a just and fair workplace. Could you talk about that some?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that there's any time that there's economic anxiety, you also see a lot of fractures in social cohesion. And I think that this election cycle has pretty much demonstrated it. I mean, I'm a political reporter. I work for 538.com. And so a lot of times I will see that the places with the most intense unemployment or the most intense volatility are places that are also socially stressed and politically stressed. And so there's a lot of evidence that, that people resort to unethical and unfair workplace practices as well when they feel threatened. And really, there's nothing that I can say that really will change the game, but I want people to at least think about these issues. So I give a bunch of ethical scenarios ranging from whistleblowers to gender discrimination and age discrimination, which is really quite profound. And if you are in a workplace, either as someone who's on the receiving end of discrimination or perhaps someone who is going along with a corporate culture and doling it out, you have to take a hard look at the situation. I mean, everyone has choices. Not all those choices are the same. But a lot of times in workplaces, if something's going on where there's a clear ethical dilemma, you can choose to be the go-along, get-along person and go with the corporate culture. But if the corporate culture is kind of poisonous, you have to make a choice about what you're going to do. I'm very clear in the book, however, that being someone who speaks up is not always rewarded, and that sometimes you do feel, very much like you can't lose this job. I'm not saying that you will then act completely out of control, but there are times where, whether you are, again, on the receiving end of discrimination or someone who's standing on the sidelines, you may not feel empowered to challenge it, and you might just want to leave. For example, I'll give you a very concrete example. A friend of mine is a gay man who, appears to many people to be straight. He's a jock. He's, super into sports. He's very masculine. And he was working in a financial services firm where people assumed not only that he was straight, but he wanted to listen to homophobic jokes and all sorts of, things like that. You don't even know who you're working with. That's something to remember. You know, if you're talking to someone white, they may be married to someone or have children who are non-white. A lot of times in an increasingly diverse society, we don't even really know the full context of the people who we're with. And for that reason alone, it's worth, if not just for ethical reasons, but also for reasons of self-preservation, it's best to assume that acting in an ethical fashion is the way to go. But I also realize that there are dilemmas when it comes to that, and I get into them very granularly in the book.
Let's bring in our callers now at 800-642-1234 as we talk to Farai Chidea about her new book, The Episodic Career, How to Thrive at Work in the Age of Disruption. Marcus is with us now in Deerfield. Marcus, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just recently got an opportunity in another state to continue my education, and I'm trying to find out what's the best way to go about getting a job in another state when I'm currently living in my home state. And I'll take my question off the air. Thank you.
Marcus, thanks for the call. Probably a lot of people dealing with some kind of similar situation. How, if you're upping stakes and moving to a new place, how do you start your career up there?
Yeah, I mean, I would love to have known more about Marcus's situation in terms of, is it feasible to split time between the two locations? Because I do think that one of the good things that has emerged from this, this era of work is that there are many more employers who are willing to do flexible location or flex time so that you can work part of the week in one location and part of the week from home. So that may or may not be a possibility for Marcus. Another question is, what is the transition? So let's say that it's not possible to commute. Is it a situation where Marcus can rent out his house or apartment for a limited amount of time and say, well, we're going to do a three-month evaluation. I'm going to stay at this company for 3 months. I plan to stay here long term, but I wanted to be sure that I shouldn't sell my house or, whether or not I should sell my house. I mean, I think employers understand now that if you have long time stakes in one community, that it can be really difficult to pull up those roots unless you feel secure. So one way to go is also really to treat this as a mutual evaluation. You have to if you even raise the prospect of that, you have to couch it in very specific terms. I'm committed to this company. I'm committed to this enterprise. I'm committed to you. I just want to make sure that we're a good fit for each other. I think it's in both of our benefits. I'm coming to start work on Tuesday, but I want to have a 3-month review, and after that, I will sell my home or give up my lease. So there's certain ways to raise these things that don't raise red flags, like what's your level of commitment? Because you don't want to seem like someone who's part of the way in. What you want to do is say, I'm all the way in. I just want to make sure that we're on the same page.
Fry, as we wrap up, can you make the case that things aren't necessarily all bad in this situation where we've said goodbye to the lifelong career and we're in a job-to-job hopping sort of situation?
Yeah, I think that unfortunately, the people who are both risk-averse and don't consider themselves good networkers can feel at a disadvantage. They're not necessarily at a disadvantage, but right now there's a lot of good that comes out of having the ability to reevaluate your career and taking proactive steps forward. But you have to be a strong networker, and you have to keep your eye on the ball. Again, the question of psychological self-employment.
And briefly, Farai, you took a big plunge in writing a book outside of your usual issue area.
Absolutely.
You think it panned out all right?
I did. I'm really happy with it, and everyone who's read, I get a lot of great feedback, including from people who are long-term unemployed and who find it helpful, as well as people who are gainfully employed and just want to stay focused. So, I feel happy about it, but it's definitely been a challenge to leave my comfort zone. And I think all of us have to leave our comfort zone. That's what the new economy is asking us to do.
Well, Farai, thanks for joining us today, and good luck in the adoption process.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it, and this has been a joy.
We've been talking to Farai Chidea. She's a journalist, a political analyst, and we've been looking at her new book. It's called The Episodic Career, How to Thrive at Work in the Age of Disruption. We have a link to some information about the book over at the Central Time Facebook page, and still looking to hear from you there. Let us know if you've made a big change lately, left a job, started a business, considering leaving a job. Maybe you don't want to give that away just yet, but let us know how that change worked out for you, what you're weighing, and what's important to you in your next career choice. Again, that's at the Central Time Facebook page. Earlier this week, we talked to Martha Barnett from the public radio show Away with Words about commonly mispronounced words and those gray area words where it seems like it could go either way.
And as usually happens when we talk about language, we heard from a lot of you. Here are some of the issues that you raised on Facebook. Sandy said, my pet peeve is fur instead of for. And Marcia said, tuh for two.
And I'll probably be saying this a lot here. I do both of those. Guilty, is it a bad thing? Is it guilty? It's a thing for us to talk about. For us to
talk about. That's
about.
The thing about this. When you say things too precisely, sometimes
right.
You sound like a robo.
I'm going to
host.
School. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Well, and watch out. They're gonna get that robo host in here any day now. And how will that robo host say that sea over there with all the islands, the Caribbean?
The Caribbean.
Or the Caribbean. Perhaps. Kathy's wondering about that. Or Katie, I'm sorry, is wondering about that one. And she says it differently depending on where. So I always say, Pirates of the Caribbean. Yeah, always that way. Caribbean cruise. Yeah, I'd say it that way.
Yeah, context-specific, right? And then there's creek or crick when referring to a small stream. That's a question Jill has.
And Fish Creek, Wisconsin. A lot of the people in that area that I've met from that area will say Fish Creek.
Wait. They really say Fish Creek?
I have talked to people who have worked there, and they say, yeah.
All right,
Fish Creek
my mind's
is
blown.
Common. And in my hometown of Belleville, Michigan, Crick was said often, too. Well, stick around. There's more to come here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.